From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And the other thing the peace movement needs to keep doing is just keep up the work, get stronger, and don't let them rest for a moment.
Those were the electronically altered words of an anti-war Marine just before he left for Iraq. He died there 2 weeks ago. We'll play an excerpt of his interview. And we'll hear from parents around the country, deeply concerned about their children in Iraq and Kuwait, deployed to the Persian Gulf.
This is a terrible moment. Even if officially the war is ended, this is not the end. The fear, the anxiety, and just the feeling of that maybe we won't see our sons again is something that is inside us all the time. It is something that doesn't allow us to sleep, to think, to concentrate at work. It has changed all our life. I'm not talking just about me, about the fear. My anxiety is about my son being deployed to Iraq, but I want to be the voice of all mothers in all the United States that have this, that are feeling the same thing that I'm feeling right now.
And savage homophobia. MSNBC has fired shock jock Michael Savage for his tirade.
All right, so you're one of those sodomists. Yeah. Are you a sodomite?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you're one of the sodomites. You should only get AIDS and die, you pig.
Yet Michael Savage remains on the air on over 300 radio stations around the country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For the first time, the White House has admitted President Bush misled Congress and the nation that Saddam Hussein was attempting to buy uranium from the African country of Niger. Bush announced the link on January 28th at his State of the Union address by saying, quote, "The British government has learned Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa." Others in the administration cited this claim repeatedly to highlight the threat Iraq posed in the weeks and months leading to the U.S. invasion. But questions of the intelligence emerged as reports indicated the CIA knew well before the State of the Union address that there was no link between Iraq and Niger. On Sunday, the New York Times ran an article by former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who last year went to Niger on a CIA-funded trip. He concluded no such transaction of uranium was ever made, but Wilson's findings were apparently ignored by the White House. As late as yesterday, White House was defending the president's statements. Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said in the afternoon, quote, "We see nothing that would dissuade us from the president's broader statement." But last night, the White House issued a statement reversing what Fleischer said. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, a parliamentary committee has issued an investigative report in Britain questioning the intelligence Prime Minister Tony Blair used to lead his country to war. Blair, the report notes, claimed Britain had other evidence that proved Iraq was trying to buy uranium. No such evidence has ever been made public. The Palestinian group Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility today for a bombing in central Israel that killed a 65-year-old Israeli woman. This comes despite a one-week-old ceasefire pledge. The group threatened more violence if Israel does not release more Palestinian prisoners. The Wall Street Journal's reporting the independent commission created to investigate the September 11th attacks is facing major hurdles from the White House and may not be able to complete its investigation by its deadline of next May. Access to White House documents and federal personnel to interview has been severely limited. The commission has only received a small portion of the documents it has requested. And interviews only began last week, 7 months after the committee was formed. Members of the commission were only allowed access to a major 900-page congressional inquiry 2 months ago. Commissioner Max Cleland, a former Democratic senator from Georgia, says of the White House, quote, It's obvious they're sifting the information to the 911 commission now. We're way, way late here. The picture is not encouraging. In Iraq, three U.S. soldiers were wounded in two explosions today in central Iraq. Meanwhile, for the second time in less than a week, U.S. troops came under a mortar attack north of Baghdad shortly before midnight. A U.S. military team of 32 arrived in Liberia yesterday to assess the situation. This could lead to a deployment of U.S. troops to restore order in the West African nation. This news from Nigeria. The police have been accused of shooting dead at least 10 demonstrators in Lagos following days of strikes and protests. This comes just days before the president's visit to Nigeria. A general strike was called to protest gas prices. We'll have more on the president's trip in Senegal in just a minute. Time magazine's reporting the U.S. troops looted and vandalized the Baghdad airport after the Iraqi capital fell in April. The troops stole duty-free items, shot up the airport, trashed five Boeing airplanes to such a degree that they may never fly again. Time magazine went on to report that terminal windows were smashed, almost every door in the airport was broken. Graffiti in English covered the walls. The total cost of the destruction could top $100 million. One senior Pentagon official told Time, quote, there was no chance this was done by Iraqis. Another military official said, soldiers do this stuff all the time, everywhere. It's warfare.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand?
Is it for freedom? Sarah Thompson here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Police have rounded up more than 1,000 people in Dakar to, they say, improve security around the visit to Senegal of President George Bush and his 600-strong tour group of staff and journalists. The roundup on Saturday night was in collaboration with U.S. security agents in Senegal ahead of Bush's arrival. This according to the Cape Times. Bush arrived in Senegal today on the first leg of a five-nation African tour. He was greeted by the president at the airport this morning, accompanied also by National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of State General Colin Powell. The trip, Bush says, is designed to work toward several goals: fighting AIDS, boosting national security, and encouraging emerging markets. During the 2000 campaign, President Bush said he would not put Africa on his priority list and was not interested in the U.S. taking on, quote, peacekeeping and nation-building responsibilities. Bush starts his visit in Senegal, as Clinton did in 1998, by visiting Gori Island off of Senegal's coast, which is the site of the symbol in the world of the transatlantic slave trade. We turn now to Diadi Ba, who is a Senegalese freelance reporter who is reporting for Reuters in Dakar, Senegal. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Oh, thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe what has happened so far today?
Well, what happened so far is when President George W. Bush arrived at the Dakar International Airport, as you said earlier, he was greeted by President Abdoulaye Wade. And then they went to the presidential palace, where he met with 8 other African leaders. And, of course, he had come here to talk about democracy, AIDS, and so on. But was top on the agenda, the Liberian crisis. And he had a talk with the ECOWAS chairman, which is the Ghanaian president, John Kufo. He, according to his word, they have a very interesting, a very important discussion regarding the Liberian crisis on the, there. And President Bush also said that when he was asked whether the U.S. is going to commit troops on the ground, he said, well, he's actually considering that question.
And what about the roundup of hundreds of people, more than 1,000 people this weekend in Dakar, in preparation for the president's trip?
Yeah, what happened is some scholars at Dakar University opposed the President Bush's stand on Iraq. And they made it very clear by staging a demonstration in the streets of the Senegalese capital, saying that they were completely opposed of the war in Iraq, and they simply wanted to be. They were very vocal, mainly scholars of Dakar University, saying that well, this was not the right time for President Bush to come here. But President Ward, of course, wanted President Bush to come here. Simply, he sees in President Bush a close ally. Now, let me remind you that during the previous Gold War, Senegal had sent troops to fight alongside the coalition against Iraq. And now, after they left the Senegalese capital, they went just some few miles off the coast of Dakar and then visited a very important shipping point from here, where millions were shipped toward the Americas in the previous centuries.
Diadi Ba, can you talk about Gori Island and its significance?
Well, Gori is a very significant point simply because, as I said earlier, the millions were, about 3 million at least, were shipped from this island. Gori has the slave house where hundreds of people were packed in a very small house made of red bricks, a very small house where the slaves were. It's a two-floor building. The masters, if I may call them so, or those people who had come to buy slaves, lived on the first floor. And then on the ground floor, there were hundreds of people packed in very small cells. And then from Gori, and from that very same house, there is a door of no return where all those people, when they cut that door, they were simply going to say goodbye to Africa for good.
We're going to go for a minute to a clip from a film about the tours of Gori Island that so many people have taken now, revisiting the site, this symbol of the transatlantic slave trade. It was produced by Transatlantic Productions in Brooklyn, talking about the ships.
Once on board, The slaves were packed between decks, which did not permit a tall man to stand upright. The women were chained together, but the men were chained in pairs, ankle to ankle, wrist to wrist. Those who were not chained together were packed in couples, side by side, like sardines, the feet of one against the head of the other. A captain of a slave ship responding to a question as to whether the slaves were comfortable in the middle passage replied, "They are about as comfortable as a man might be in a coffin." A surgeon on board a slave ship responsible for their health care described the deck where the captives were kept as a slaughterhouse. The crossing from West Africa to the Americas and the West Indies was generally referred to as the Middle Passage, and this usually took about 50 days. It was referred to as the Middle Passage because it represented the slave trader's round trip out from his home port to Africa, to the West Indies, and back to his home port.
For the captive to have had the opportunity to jump ship and got drowned in the Middle Passage was a triumph, even though it might be viewed as suicide by others. Death was preferable to African captive to living his ancestral home.
An excerpt of a tour of Gori Island and the description of the ships used to transport the Africans to, you can't quite say, the free world. You are listening to Democracy Now! As Bush is in Senegal visiting Gori Island. Our guest on the line, Diadi Ba, Senegalese freelance journalist reporting for Reuters from Dakar. Where does Bush go from here, and your assessment of his trip to your country?
Can you repeat that question again,
please? Your assessment of Bush's trip to your country and what people expect to get out of it.
Well, I think people are expecting President Bush here to just make some commitments regarding aiding the African continent in terms of, let's say, opening more the American market to not only to Senegal, but also to other African countries. Because here, when you ask people what they really want from this trip, they will tell you, okay, we want, of course, more consideration. And also, we want them to make our products have access to their market. But now it seems that they have put the American authorities has put the standard of our product very, very high. And of course, there are many small businesses who want to do business with the United States, but they simply don't have enough means to upgrade, if I may say, those criteria. But on the other hand, also, they think as far as also the some crises are concerned here in Africa, particularly now, the ongoing crisis for 14 years now in Liberia. Some do believe that given the fact that there are historical link with between Liberia and the United States, they wanted to see America play a greater role in that regard.
And the United States is, the Bush administration, very interested in access to be able to refuel their warplanes in both Senegal and in Uganda. Is that right?
Yeah, I think definitely the American, the Bush administration is trying now to be more concerned towards those countries which they have labeled democratic countries, and maybe thinking that other countries also will follow the very same path. But of course, there are also other people who believe that America has shown also a great deal, if I may say, of arrogance in dealing with some regional issues. And well, they do believe that, of course, it has to play a role, but also at the same time, trying at least to have a better approach in dealing with those issues as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dia Diba, joining us from Dakar, Senegal, a freelance reporter for Reuters. Also, no small irony that on the eve of President Bush's trip, the Bush administration finally admits that they used an African country as a cover, as a kind of ruse for the invasion of Iraq, saying the Niger, that Saddam Hussein had attempted to get uranium from the African country of Niger, now admitting that they knew this was not the case. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll hear the voice of a U.S. Marine before he was killed in Iraq just a few weeks ago. He was anti-war, an active member of the peace movement. And then we'll hear from his friends and parents of soldiers who are deployed to the Persian Gulf, deeply concerned about their loved ones. Stay with us. Yasun Dur here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 2 weeks ago, a Marine was killed in Iraq, the day before he was deployed. An independent reporter, Ingrid Drake, interviewed him. The interview was broadcast on Pacifica's Peace Watch. Today, we're going to play an excerpt from that interview. In it, the Marine voiced his opposition to the war and his support for the peace movement. He was an active member of Peace Action, was involved in the anti-war protests. At the time, he asked not to be identified. His voice was electronically altered. Through friends and family, his parents have asked that his voice continue to be masked and that he not be identified. Today, we're going to play an excerpt of the interview of this anti-war Marine who just recently died in Iraq.
I believe in the United States. I believe in the Constitution. I think it's perhaps one of the greatest documents ever written. I believe in the idea that we, the people, are the sovereign and that we determine our own destiny. The ideas of democracy and the Bill of Rights and freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, due process. And those are things that are truly worth defending, and that somebody has to do that.
Can you talk about whether you think going at this point will be defending the values that you've just expressed?
My opinion is that no. The constant rhetoric of the administration is that there's going to be one person who decides when we go to war. He decides, or in the rhetoric, I get to decide when we go to war. And that is such a blatant violation of every constitutional principle that our founding fathers came up with. The Declaration of Independence talks about declaring independence from England based upon the fact that their lives are being ruled and determined by one man. And it's completely undemocratic to allow one man to decide, or one woman to decide, when we go to war, when we fight, when people have to sacrifice themselves. And the Constitution is very clear that it is Congress who declares war. Even beyond that, it's we the people. That's what this nation is about. It isn't about politics or personal agendas or political agendas or economic agendas. And I believe that this war is not the right thing for America because it hasn't yet been proven conclusively that there's a threat to we the people. The American people should be allowed to decide whether or not this is a risk that they want to take. And then it should be presented to the United Nations as a risk that the world wants to take. Because that is what we're talking about here. This is not our backyard here. This is something that's thousands of miles away. And the consequences affect us, but they also affect the 188 other members of the United Nations. This could have repercussions in terms of the war on terrorism. It could have repercussions on international diplomacy. It could have repercussions on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It could have repercussions in terms of our ability to get anything else done in the UN. And even if we come out scot clean, victorious, and there's no American casualties and everything goes the way it's supposed to go, what does that mean for the world order? It sets up that we basically can do whatever we want to do whenever we want to do it because we're the world's sole superpower.
Have you been briefed or have special precautions been taken in the case of depleted uranium and use of depleted uranium?
No, nothing. I know that given what I do for the Marine Corps, if I am sent to the Persian Gulf, then I may very well have access to materials that involve depleted uranium, but I know nothing about them. I've never been briefed on them, except that they're safe and that there's no problems, there's no drawbacks, there's no side effects. But that's only from what I got in a book. I haven't really done my own research on this subject, though I've heard things, I've read things about Gulf War Syndrome. I really haven't pursued it. I think it's in part because I think in this case, ignorance is bliss. If I'm given a job that involves handling depleted uranium, I just can't say no.
Do you think there is any way that the U.S. can bring freedom to the Iraqi people following an invasion?
It seems difficult to me that when you drop 250, 500, 750, 1,000-pound warheads on a city like Baghdad or on a population, it's very difficult for the Iraqi people to imagine that that after we bomb them, and it can only be for 3 or 4 days, as they're promising, and after 12 years of sanctions, after the propaganda that the Ba'ath regime has spread about the United States and its involvement with the Zionist government, Israel, and all that stuff, that they're just going to run out into the street and hug American soldiers. Yeah, you dropped a 1,000-pound warhead on my house and killed my mother, my father, my brother, but hey, thanks, because now you're rid of Saddam Hussein. It doesn't seem consistent with the history of the Iraqi people. I mean, they're amazing, proud people, but they should not be seen as just a bunch of backwater, third-age, stone-age people who are just going to do whatever we want them to do. They are as intelligent, as proud, as strong as we are.
What would you like to see the anti-war movement or the peace movement or the international growing movement against attack of Iraq? What would you like to see their messages being and some of their tactics?
Well, I think the movement is awesome. It's wonderful. I've been very privileged to be involved in it. And that's a wonderful freedom that as an American I get to enjoy. I get to be in the military, but I also get to protest and march. The key thing they have to do first in the United States is they have to talk about the troops and their support for them. It was wonderful to see signs on big rally over Martin Luther King Day saying, you know, we support our troops, so bring them home. And that's a wonderful sentiment, and that needs to be talked about. The problems of chemical warfare and urban combat and depleted uranium and Gulf War Syndrome, the peace movement needs to bring these up and say, hey, look, these are the issues that our troops will be facing that you're not addressing, or you haven't addressed in the past. And I think the peace movement could do itself a great service by not pitting itself against those of us who are doing our duty by serving, but by helping us in bringing our problems forward and demanding that we solve. And that's the big thing. Also, it needs to bring up some of the lies the administration has been telling about the involvement of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, for example, which the FBI and CIA, even as recently as this week, said, well, we still don't have any conclusive evidence. And that's significant when our nation's CIA, our nation's intelligence arm is saying, well, it's inconclusive and sketchy. You have to follow that out. And the other thing the peace movement needs to keep doing is just keep up the work, get stronger, and don't let them rest for a moment.
Marine killed in Iraq several weeks ago. His voice electronically altered. He did this interview the day before he left for Iraq with Ingrid Drake, and it was broadcast on Pacifica's Peace Watch. We're joined on the line now by one of his friends, Jen Carr, coordinator of the Washington Peace Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jen.
Thanks.
It's good to have you with us. You know, you've attended his funeral. You also received letters from him in Iraq. Can you talk a little about him? We are not identifying him at his parents' request.
Yeah.
But if you could share some of his thoughts and letters that you received.
I'll read one excerpt from a letter. Hello?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got a little dial tone. Okay, this letter is dated in April 19th, and it says, being here, I have seen just how absurd this war and all its pretense really was. The decay of the cities and towns is not new nor ancient. Something once thrived here, business, trade, agriculture, the military. The toll of sanctions is clearly evident. So much started, left unfinished. So much done, left falling apart. There are layers of dust made thick from time. Scourging and looting are clearly a learned skill, not something done in euphoric moments after the war. I saw much purpose and deliberateness of scheme as everything from lumber to tires to doors were driven, rolled, or dragged through my checkpoint. Military bases, those that I have seen, many, are merely reflective of a power once held. They held out longer, but that decay is still there. I laugh to think that this nation and this military posed a threat to us so far away. I think that this person was a highly dedicated Marine. It's not a simple story to lay out. This person actually overcame obstacles and difficulties to become a Marine, and he was very proud of his Marine service and always said that, you know, if duty called, he would go. He was very, very loyal that way, but still opposed to the war for reasons that you've heard from his voice, reasons that, you know, he couldn't see that this country could possibly pose a threat to us. You know, and he worked with equal dedication for the peace movement, I think, because of these conflicting views that he held. I think that he very strongly wanted to fulfill the honor and the obligation that he felt as a Marine, but that he also really wanted to do something to help express the views of the anti-war movement, which he could see had, you know, such credibility. And very, very complex person that way, and it's a real learning experience to meet somebody like this. I know that he was thrilled from the letters. His words are thrilled when he actually heard. It took a while to hear, I think, about some of the massive protests. When he started working, the protests were smaller. And, you know, even without it being very glamorous at the time, he worked in a very dedicated way at some really mundane tasks, you know, such as the life of an organizer. It's not all very glamorous. You know, a lot of it was compiling media so that we could keep track of how we were being covered in the news, compiling contact so that, you know, we could work more efficiently and sending out mailings. You know, he went to protests and he supported protests and was very present that way. But a lot of the work, I think, you know, he probably worked in a similarly dedicated manner as a Marine, just, you know, doing the tasks. I would imagine getting to know him that he was an incredible soldier, as strange as that is. You know, he was just such a very accountable and very thorough person, and really strove. If something was a challenge to him, that made him all the more dedicated to wanting to succeed. And I imagine that, you know, it's a loss to us, and I imagine for his comrades in Iraq, it's just an incredible loss as well. I don't want to go on and on, but there were amazing stories from his commanding officer in Iraq that, I mean, just amazingly enough, this person who had carried such a strong sentiment for peace before the war managed to be in conflict and still carry forward sentiments for peace. He was very learned about the Middle East and had actually studied Arabic for 2 years and knew some Arabic. And there's a story of him. The Marines had met Ba'ath Party leaders in a house, And I guess the typical Marine MO might have been to just start shooting. But this person, with his, you know, incredible linguistic skill and incredible dedication to diplomacy and peace, he actually went in and talked and negotiated a surrender situation instead of just having the people get killed. And the stories that I heard during, you know, spending time meeting people at the funeral say that wasn't an isolated situation, that there were both U.S. soldiers and Iraqi civilians or, you know, Iraqis whose lives were saved because this person cared, you know, so much and had bothered to learn so much about the Middle East and the language and the culture and actually cared to take, you know, such a brave, I think, an incredibly brave, braver than just running off with your gun cocked, in my mind, that, you know, to go in and try to negotiate with these people was just an incredible act of bravery. And
did it shock you, Jen, that he decided to go to Iraq?
Excuse me?
Did it shock you that he decided to go to Iraq, or did you only know him when he knew he was being deployed?
I met him. I knew the whole time since the very day I met him that, you know, he was already a Marine, and he always told me from the get-go that if he had to go, he would go. And I actually was not shocked. I find it, you know, we all, nothing is black and white. And I could just really admire him, actually, for feeling that way, because, you know, despite the support of the anti-war movement that he held, and despite his feelings, he had made an important obligation. He had worked really hard to become a very good, you know, I mean, he was a very, I'm sure he was a very capable soldier, and he had worked hard at it and overcome obstacles from what I can hear from his family. And also just the bonds that you must develop as you meet people. You know, you're going through training and camp, and you're meeting people and developing relationships. And, you know, you don't want to be the one who doesn't support your fellow comrades that you've built these strong ties with. So I never felt anything except, you know, that this must be such a hard conflict to carry around in your heart.
Jen Carr, I want to thank you for being with us. His last statement, his last letter that he sent out, said that I have died means I have failed to achieve the one thing in life I truly longed to give the world, peace. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we continue to talk about soldiers in Iraq. Today, three U.S. soldiers wounded in two explosions in central Iraq. Meanwhile, for the second time in less than a week, U.S. troops came under a mortar attack north of Baghdad shortly before midnight. The attacks come days after President Bush taunted Iraqis by saying, "Bring them on," when asked by reporters if the U.S. could handle the increasing number of attacks. This all comes as morale, both there and here, among the troops and their families, has reached a new low. The New York Times reports in Fort Stewart, Georgia, a colonel recently had to be escorted out by military security after a meeting with 800 seething spouses, most of them wives. One official at Fort Stewart told the Times they were crying, cussing, yelling, and screaming for their men to come back. We're joined on the phone by Julian Borger, who is a reporter for The Guardian in Britain. He is based in D.C. and has been in Georgia covering this story. Can you describe what's going on in the area of Fort Stewart? Julian.
Well, it's Hinesville, west of Fort Stewart. It's a very quiet town at the moment because most of the population, at least half of it, is away in Iraq, and the other half is the spouses, mainly wives, trying to get on with life, but as single parents, and there is a definite sense of bitterness because it's the home of the 3rd Infantry Division, which went in first, did at least half the fighting along the road to Baghdad, and there's a feeling that they shouldn't still be there and shouldn't still be fighting the insurgency, and there is a sense in which they feel that their soldiers have done more than their fair share.
Patrick Donahue is also on the line with us. He is the editor of the Coastal Courier in Georgia, covers that community. Is this unusual, the feelings that the hundreds of family members are having right now in this kind of meeting where a colonel has to be actually escorted out by the military to protect him from the military families who are so angry?
Well, this is because even after Desert Storm, when this division deployed, those troops were back within a matter of weeks, really. So this is really kind of a new experience again for the Army to because these guys and these families were told, you get to Baghdad and you depose Saddam Hussein and you end the regime and we'll get you out of there. Well, they went to Baghdad and they deposed Saddam Hussein and they removed most of the elements of power of the regime, and then they were told that they had to stay a little longer. And so I think the anger and the resentment were expected. A lot of the wives I have spoken to were very upset when they heard from their husbands, and I heard from the higher command that that they were going to be coming home in June, like everybody had anticipated. But a lot of them said, the command said they'll be home in August, so we're gonna pin our hopes on hoping they'll be home by August. And as it turns out, yesterday the division released a redeployment timeline, said we're gonna be sending some more guys home this weekend and through next week, and hopefully by the beginning of August, the entire division will be out of Iraq and either in Kuwait or on its way back to the United States. So I will say that the mood today is probably going to be a lot better than it was a month ago.
We're going to break, and then we're joined by a mother whose son is in Kuwait. She's terrified he'll be sent into Iraq. And also by a father whose son is in the Persian Gulf. Stay with us.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all.
Universal Soldier, Buffy St. Marie. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the studio with us, Andrea Vedas. Her son has been deployed to the Persian Gulf, now in Kuwait. Your feelings right now?
I have so many feelings. At the beginning, it was a feeling of fear, then feeling of anxiety, and now those feelings have changed to be resentment, bitterness, because they also are like playing with the feelings of the mothers that are waiting for our sons to come back. That's how we want that our troops come back. And they said in June that they were coming back. It never happened. And after that, they have changed the dates 3 or 4 times. And they are not here yet. And also there is the possibility that they have, after they're in Kuwait, they have to come back to Iraq. And that's another feeling, because listening to my song after 4 months without knowing anything, just getting 3 letters from him, is really tough for me, thinking about what he feels coming back to do something that he didn't agree with since the beginning. Because even if he was proud to be an American soldier, to comply with his obligation, his duty for his country, he didn't agree with the idea of going to war, because we didn't have really a reason to go to war. This is all wrong. This is only one person's decision. It was only to prove his power. And you know of whom we are talking about now. It's only one person's feelings, and I think he is the one who should go to Iraq and fight Saddam Hussein himself. I just want our soldiers to come back and to finish this anxiety, this fear, these feelings so bad that have changed all our life.
You participated in peace marches.
Yes, I went to almost all rallies made in New York. I also went twice to Washington. And I also helped, you know, giving flyers on the subways, in the bus stops, in my neighborhood, everywhere, even in the church.
We're also joined on the phone by Guy Hallman, who is a father of a man who's also been deployed to the Persian Gulf. Where is your son now, Guy Hallman?
Actually, we hadn't heard from our son in a couple of weeks, and we just heard from him last night, and right now he's in Kuwait, but he's been going back and forth between Iraq and Kuwait. And when we don't hear from him for a while, we assume he's in Iraq, but when he's in Kuwait, he can occasionally call.
And what are your thoughts today?
Well, at this stage right now, I'm pretty angry about this whole thing, because, you know, I think this whole war was built up on pretexts that were false, blatantly false. You know, they weren't just bad intelligence or misunderstandings. I think we were pushed into this war, and here it certainly looks like the war had nothing to do with stability of Iraq and setting up a democracy or some other form of government that would be stable, because we didn't seem to be planned for it at all. We're just over there now, reacting to the situation day by day, and we don't seem to be in control. I mean, we're reacting to, as was mentioned earlier, daily attacks on our soldiers. It seems almost we've got one per day that is getting killed and others wounded, and it's just a situation that doesn't seem to be getting any better.
Patrick Donahue of the Coastal Courier, these kind of sentiments, did you hear them expressed before this invasion?
No, not really. The support of the administration and the support of the decision to go to war was pretty universal here. Whether or not they turn up WMD or not, the overriding sentiment here among the families and the soldiers, especially the ones I talked to when I was over there, was, you know, we're probably going to have to go to war, and, you know, that's what we're trained to do. And, you know, our mission is to knock Saddam Hussein out of power. And a lot of them said, let's get it right this time, so we don't have to come back. And it's the way it's been all along. And I think most of the folks here still back the decision to go across the border. You know, whether or not any WMD evidence is turned up, I don't think it's going to have that much of an effect on how they feel. I think right now they're just happy that most of their boys and girls are going to be coming home within the next 3 to 4 weeks.
Julian Borger, you're a British reporter, but you're here covering what's happening in the United States and the soldiers in the area for the British paper The Guardian. Are there similar sentiments in Britain? Front page of the New York Times today, a big picture of soldiers sitting in Iraq, having just been told that their stay has been extended in Iraq, and it's a clear picture of, well, it looks like from resignation to disappointment. Julian Borger.
Sentiments in Britain, or?
Are you seeing similarities?
In Britain, there is a much more, you could call it aggressive disillusion with the case for the war. I mean, I agree with Pat and Tyler, and it was my finding in Hinesville, that fundamentally people still believed in the war. They just thought that their boys ought to be home, and it was time for someone else to have a go. Britain is very different, because there was much deeper skepticism about the case for war, and the failure to come across WMD, and the issue of how truthful the case made by Tony Blair and George Bush for the war is a much more live issue in Britain than it is here. I found too that in Hinesville and across the country, the general opinion, although it's ebbing away a bit, the general opinion is that we had to get rid of this guy. If we'd left him in power, sooner or later he'd come after us with weapons of mass destruction. Whether he had them on hand or not at the time of the war, in Britain there's greater skepticism over whether Saddam Hussein was a serious threat.
And a much more aggressive investigation into why false documents were presented as real ones, this being, just last night, the Bush administration finally admitting that their statements were false about Niger selling uranium to Iraq. I'm going to give Andrea Veras the last word, again, her son in Kuwait.
I just want to say that we should still fight against the war. We should do our best to bring our troops home and to really to have peace, not only in the United States, but also in Iraq. And those people suffering too much, and they also deserve to be in peace. Please do the best you can to bring our troops home.
Andrea Veras, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and Guy Hallman. Both of their children are in Iraq and Kuwait, or going back and forth. Julian Borger of The Guardian, based in Washington, D.C., and Patrick Donahue, editor of The Coastal Courier of Georgia. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move into our last segments. 5 months ago, MSNBC overhauled their schedule. The network's most progressive voice, Phil Donahue, was out. A team of well-known conservatives was quickly hired. An internal study leaked to media critic Rick Ellis described Donahue as a, quote, tired left-wing liberal out of touch with the current marketplace. The report went on to say Donahue presented a difficult face for NBC at a time of war. The station feared Donahue's show would become, quote, a home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity. One of Phil Donahue's replacements was Michael Savage. Well, let's take a listen to an excerpt from Michael Savage's most recent show. It was on Saturday.
All right. So you're one of those sodomists. Yeah. Are you a sodomite?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you're one of the sodomites. You should only get AIDS and die, you pig. How's that? Oh. Why don't you see if you can sue me, you pig? You got nothing better than to put me down, you piece of garbage? You got nothing to do today? Go eat a sausage and choke on it. Get trichinosis. Okay, we have another nice caller here who's busy because he didn't have a nice night in the bathhouse, is angry at me today. Huh? Get me another one. Put another sodomite on. No more calls? I don't care. Let's go to the next scene. I don't care about these bums. They mean nothing to me. They're all sausages. Next scene. On to the next scene on the Savage Nation.
And that, an excerpt of Michael Savage's Savage Nation on MSNBC. MSNBC has announced that they have terminated their contract with him. The quote in the New York Times highlighted of MSNBC says, Savage Nation ends, a decision MSNBC says was not difficult. Steve Rendell joins us of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who has been highlighting Michael Savage's statements, not only of today, but of yesterday and the day before that. Welcome to Democracy Now! Your comments.
It's always great to be here, Amy. I guess the first thing I would say is this was all very predictable from 5 months ago. MSNBC went into this with their eyes opened. They'd been informed about Savage's bigotry, not only his homophobia, but his racism, his misogyny, his bashing of immigrants, which are, it's well known. We could go over that if you like. That's also available at the FAIR website. This was all known. Groups like GLAAD, like FAIR, Dan Zoll at the San Francisco Bay Guardian, Michael Savage Sucks, the website, Savage Stupidity, another website, had all put Savage's bigotry on the record. MSNBC went into this with their eyes opened. And I think this whole 5 months, the whole story beginning back in February when Phil Donahue was fired, as you mentioned, provides a glimpse into the mind of the corporate network executive, and it's not pretty. What you see is a cynical, amoral, if immoral, sort of machination. Here were a bunch of network executives that said, Michael Savage, how come we haven't heard of this guy before? He's got a hot radio show, and he's got a book that's number one on the Times bestseller list. We got to get this guy. And when they announced that they were hiring him, they got a lot of these groups that I mentioned, contacted MSNBC and NBC. Let's not forget, we're talking about Eric Sorensen, the president of MSNBC. We're talking about Bob Wright, the president of NBC. And in between there, Neil Shapiro. These are people that decided to hire Savage because he was hot, in spite of everything they knew about his bigotry. At the same time, these cynics promoted the Savage Show as expanding the marketplace of idea and a gesture to free speech at the same time that they were firing the Phil Donahue Show. The only show on the network, in fact, arguably on cable news or broadcast networks, that represented and had regular ties to the peace movement. I mean, it really does give you a glimpse inside the corporate network executive's mind that they thought that airing bigotry, outright racism, misogyny, homophobia was safer because it targeted powerless or relatively powerless people than airing the views of Phil Donahue, who targeted the powerful agendas that are operating in the country.
Do you think it was the comments or the low ratings?
Well, I think probably both. I don't think you can separate those. And I think any kind of journalism that's worth the title journalism should look into the fact that he was not doing very well to begin with. MSNBC's argument all along was that, well, he doesn't do this on MSNBC. He doesn't say these things on MSNBC. Well, now they've heard it. And to tell you the truth, over the last 15 episodes of his show, he has used a lot of code word bigotry as far as race, as far as bashing immigrants and so forth.
What about the fact while he has been kicked off of MSNBC, he is on 300 radio stations around the country?
Well, that's a great point to make because one of the reasons that Savage has been able to operate as long as he has. He started a show about 9 years ago in San Francisco on KSFO, a station owned by Disney, the ABC radio network, a station within the ABC radio network. Those 300 stations that are still carrying his show is really, that's his bread and butter. I mean, to get a show on MSNBC on Saturday, which is graveyard in cable news land, was really sort of icing on his cake.
What about free speech?
He still has most of his shows. Well, free speech is an important thing. And anybody who's going to argue that Michael Savage, who still appears on 300 stations, has somehow suffered a a diminution of his free speech is wrong. I mean, Michael Savage is probably around 200, 300 people in the country of 280 million who enjoy free speech more than anybody else.
I want to thank you for being with us, Steve Rendell, of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, their website, fair.org. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. By the way, if you'd like to find out more about the film on Gory Island, you can call Transatlantic Productions at 718-859-4046. That's 718-859-4046. Our website is democracynow.org. You can sign up for our daily digest, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Presley, Nina Nadal, and Vilka Tsouris. Rich Kim, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.